Hello everyone, this is Dark Journalist. Today we're going to be joined by Oxford scholar Dr. Joseph Farrell for a deep dive into the genesis of the deep state and how it has controlled our lives for over a century. Dr. Farrell's new book, McCarthy, Marshall, Roosevelt, and America's Progressivist Deep State, explores the roots of our current political turmoil and societal dysfunction. Today in this special Part 2 episode, we'll look into the players in the deep state and how their agenda has played out over decades on the American stage of politics, and how this all leads to a secret system of finance and the UFO file. Here we go. Dr. Joseph Farrell, The Genesis of the Deep State, Part 2. Joseph, thank you for joining us for part two of this important discussion on the deep state genesis.
Let's backtrack this mess back to the election of 1948.
Okay.
Which you picked up on the figures involved, and it seems like the 1948 election sets up House Un-American activities, and it sets up McCarthy, really. He shows up kind of in the wake of that. It was pretty clear that Truman was not going to win. He was widely unpopular in the country. And they were running Dewey for a second time, who had been the Attorney General of New York and then Governor of New York.
Right.
So he is running with Earl Warren, who becomes Supreme Court Justice and will oversee the Warren Commission. Interesting combination, Dewey and Warren.
Very.
How do you see Thomas Dewey, and what were you trying to bring out about him in the book?
Well, Thomas Dewey is another one of these people that knew that there was a real odor to Pearl Harbor and that there was a real odor to Roosevelt's administration, because in 1944, General Marshall wrote Dewey a letter, because Marshall had heard that Dewey was planning to make an issue during the 44 campaign of foreknowledge of the Pearl Harbor attack on the part of the Roosevelt administration and of on the part of the president himself. And Dewey actually met with this colonel that was carrying Marshall's letter in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He was on a campaign stop in Tulsa. And Dewey's reaction to Marshall's request not to mention it. And Marshall said, we don't want you to mention it because we don't want the Japanese to know that we've cracked their codes. In other words, his ostensible reason was national security, which understandable during a war. And Dewey's initial reaction to this colonel was to blow his stack and say that, I'll tell you what I think. I think Franklin Roosevelt knew about it and that he should be impeached for it.
Wow.
So in other words, his initial reaction was not to go along. Marshall contacted him a second time and again pleaded with him, don't make this a campaign issue. And Dewey finally relented and did not mention the foreknowledge of Pearl Harbor as a campaign issue. But that should tell us that Dewey, for whatever his sources were, for someone like that to be willing to make it a campaign issue, he's not just shooting from the hip. He's got some source of information that he's reliant upon. Now, in 48, Dewey, what's very interesting is that by the time that campaign is underway, a fellow by the name of George Morgenstern has published the first revisionist history of Pearl Harbor. And the whole thesis of Morgenstern is kind of the Howard Weisberg of Pearl Harbor research. He's the first man out of the gate with a book challenging the whole narrative of Pearl Harbor and saying this was absolutely a setup, Roosevelt knew about it, he's complicit, blah, blah, blah. He is to Pearl Harbor research what Harold Weisberg was to JFK research. He's the first out of the gate with a book, and over the decades since, that book has stood up very well, because you look at the Pearl Harbor revisionist literature out there, at some point it's reliant on Weisberg's research.
Okay?
That means that Dewey, with the book coming out in 1948, Dewey, had he won the election, I think probably would have pressed that issue simply for the political capital that it could have given him to undo or roll back aspects of the New Deal. And of course, we know the history. You know, Truman actually went on to win the 48 election, surprisingly.
Yes.
Very, very surprisingly. You know, and you've got to have some sympathy for Truman. I mean, he comes into office. Roosevelt has kept him completely out of the loop on just about everything. Right. All of a sudden, you know, he's president, and he's being told about A-bombs, and, you know. You got to have some sympathy for the guy. You know,
he
didn't have any kind of relationship with Roosevelt whatsoever, you know, and Truman is inheriting all of this, you know, infiltration of the government mess from Roosevelt. And then all of a sudden you got this hick from Wisconsin saying, oh, you know, Mr. President, you got to take care of this. You know, I've always had some sympathy for the guy, because he's stepping into a situation that is entirely not any of his making, and everybody wants him to fix it overnight. So, yeah, Dewey, I think, would have had he won that election, there's no doubt in my mind, he would have made a Pearl Harbor investigation top priority for the political capital that it may have given him to roll back aspects of the New Deal. And again, Dewey, let's remember, it's Eisenhower that shuts down the Taft wing of the party, not Thomas Dewey. Dewey has to play ball with them to get where he wants to be.
Right.
So you're dealing with a very different political situation in 48 with Dewey than you are in 52 with Dwight Eisenhower.
Right. And you have all these strange things around that election. Strom Thurmond will work closely with Philip Corso.
Yep.
And even write the opening to Corso's book. And, you know, we know Colonel Corso and what he had to say about the UFO file.
Right.
That's strange. And then Henry Wallace is running on the progressive ticket.
Yep.
He's opening up a third party.
Yep.
He's really giving it a foundation. He knows that they're not going to win, but he's saying we need a different way to do this. And that's he's representing those progressives and who got bounced out of having him as president.
Well, remember also that when Wallace is doing this in 48, that Robert La Follette in Wisconsin had previously run as a senator during the Roosevelt era on the Progressive Party ticket. So there's more very odd little things there going on. La Follette was not popular with the Taft wing, needless to say, of the Republican Party in Wisconsin. And they wanted to unseat him, and, you know, they got McCarthy to do it, and he did.
What do you think the op was behind La Follette?
That's hard to tell, but given Suzanne's presence on the Dewey Committee and her central role in compiling the final, actually writing the final report, I strongly suspect that relationship, that the La Follette family, let's put it this way, was probably inclined to some sort of soft type of moderated Trotskyism, if you want to put it that way. And certainly that connection to the La Follette family with her and her connection to the whole Dewey Commission thing, which if you read it carefully, really was a whitewash of Trotsky. It's very clear, particularly with some of the information that's come out since then. Trotsky very clearly lied about certain things.
Right.
But again, he wasn't under oath or anything like that. But I strongly suspect that playing in the background of Wisconsin politics at that time, since you had the Colemans, you had the Harnischvegers, and all of these people behind McCarthy, what they're worried about is that whole tendency in the La Follette family, and they want to take it out once and for all and for good. And McCarthy does, because La Follette's never returned to any sort of prominence after him.
Gotcha. The that's fascinating. One last thing about Wallace, which is in Kennedy histories, there's a letter where President-elect Kennedy writes a letter to Wallace asking him if he wants any post in his administration.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of reference.
Yeah, it is.
For somebody who was basically ousted from power over 15 years earlier.
Right. It is, and I suspect that, you know, the Kennedys, particularly John, were very conservative in terms of their foreign policy, but they were, you know, like McCarthy himself, you know, they were New Dealers at a certain point. It's important for people to remember McCarthy at one point was a Democrat and an ardent New Dealer supporter. Right. So, you know, in terms of domestic policy, that doesn't surprise me that the Kennedys would reach out to someone like Henry Wallace and try to bring his base back into the umbrella of the party. Doesn't surprise me at all.
Fascinating. Wow. I saw it as a real connecting bridge from that period. Mm-hmm. The Roosevelt, the Rosie Fields period, in a sense, that you talked about.
Well, it's in a certain sense, it's very good politics for him to have done that, because he's reaching out to a branch of the party that, you know, has deep New Deal roots.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a way for Kennedy to signal that, you know, I'm still part, in spite of my hawkish talk about communist threats and so on, I'm still part of this New Deal era, part of this New Deal philosophy. So it's makes perfect political sense for him to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Wow. How did you feel in the presence of FDR in this book? And now that you've sort of gone in deeper on FDR, you found him collecting control files of a blackmail sex nature. You found him preparing Pearl Harbor as an act to get America into war. How are you seeing Roosevelt? What is the real picture we're supposed to get from this book on him?
Well, it's up to the individual readers of the book to make up their own minds of what they think about President Roosevelt. I have, you know, quite honestly, I'm very traditional in my cultural political thinking. So I was never a Roosevelt fan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want the government involved in my retirement. I don't want the government involved in my health care. I want them to defend the country, pave the roads, and deliver the mail. And that's about it. You know? So, you know, I have never been a Roosevelt fan for all of the above reasons. But the thing I take away from it is that The thing that really just set me back was that whole business of him collecting these files on homosexuals in the Navy. Because that's so at odds with the character of the man that we've been presented, you know, courageous fighter against polio and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, he certainly had his sufferings on that score. That's not to be denied him. But that set me back, because it gives you the impression of a man who is so out for power that he's willing to bend all the rules to achieve it. And you see this once he takes office, you know, the court packing scheme and a bunch of other things that he tries under the New Deal, you know, camps for people to go around and work, you know.
Right.
And okay, it's bad if Hitler and Stalin do it, but it's okay if Franklin does it.
Right. Yeah, right.
it confirms my deepest suspicions about the man, but in the same way it's a disappointment because it's so at odds with the narrative that we have about him. Mm-hmm. And that's my personal reaction. You know, people can read the book and take something entirely different away from it. But that's my personal reaction to it.
Amazing. And how would you see Eleanor Roosevelt?
Oh. Oh, I'm going to have to go for electroshock after that. Well, how do I see Eleanor Roosevelt? Let me put it this way. I believe it was God and Man at Yale. William F. Buckley Jr. had just a priceless quotation about Eleanor Roosevelt. And it goes something like, on her flower-strewn march through history, Eleanor Roosevelt manages to spread her squid-like ink of confusion pretty much everywhere she goes. That kind of sums up how I think of Eleanor Roosevelt. Well, you know, the only thing worse than Eleanor Roosevelt that I can think of are people who like to channel her and talk to her. Not to make any references to contemporary political figures or anything.
Joseph, the Secret System of Finance and the UFO File make appearances mm-hmm. through these two books.
Yes, definitely.
If we were to take those two things before and after the McCarthy hearings, would you say that after the McCarthy hearings, that whole thing goes into serious lockdown?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's very clear. Particularly when you read those Monmouth transcripts. And again, folks, let's remember, they were declassified in 2003. Ostensibly because, well, all the people are dead, now we can declassify the transcripts.
Right.
And that was under the chairmanship of Senator Lieberman from Connecticut when he was still in the Senate. And you'll find all sorts of interesting names on that committee. Chuck Schumer, what's his name from Tennessee? I forget the Republican guy from Tennessee. A lot of very interesting names on that committee, including Lieberman. And my suspicion is they declassified it because, not so much because of the people are all dead. I suspect that this may have been an attempt to perhaps bring some of these things to light that they knew were wrong, but they were hoping just to kind of put it out there quietly, like Hidden System of Finance, which is clear in those transcripts. I spent a lot of time with that section of the transcripts. Because you'd have to have blinders on, Daniel, to be in the Senate and looking at these appropriation bills, not to know that something is way, way wrong and way mm-hmm. off, even if you're Chuck Schumer. I mean, you just have to know that there's something very bad going on. That's my suspicion. But I definitely think that because of what Senator McCarthy and his committee were uncovering in relationship to Monmouth and this hidden system of finance, I definitely think it went into lockdown because, again, like I say, those hearings are the direct cause of the Army McCarthy hearings. And when you examine the machinations that went on behind the scenes prior to those hearings, it's very clear that the Eisenhower administration and the Pentagon had determined, we've got to shut this guy down. Mm-hmm. You know, we've just got to shut him down by hook or crook. And I think it's because of what was being uncovered in those Monmouth hearings. They just had to shut him down. And you're right. After that whole system goes on such lockdown that you don't even really see it surfacing in any direct way in the constellation of little factoids that are hovering around the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
That's how tightly they locked that down. You don't really get a glimpse of something going wrong in this hidden system of finance really until Nixon.
Right.
So I'm agreed with you. That's the date that they lock this thing down real tight. And interestingly enough, you know, it's under the Trump administration that we've had those FASB 56 regulations that basically, I'm agreed with Catherine Fitz here, have taken the whole federal government budget black.
Right.
So, you know, they've locked it down even more because it's too apparent by now to anyone with eyes to look that there's something massively wrong with the world financial system. Right. And I think that's a huge part of it.
Well, it's amazing because there's no transparency in that coming from the Trump administration.
No, no, it's the exact opposite of transparency. It's complete opacity.
It's so, yeah, too, because this isn't even something that occurred under Obama or Bush. Mm-mm. Shocking. It also shows the level that we're at now, where because there's been things that have come out, there's your work that's out there, there's Kaplan's work, there's more attention on the idea of missing money. Even Forbes had a cover missing money because of Mark Skidmore working Fitz on that.
Yep.
So they have to play with the idea in public. Therefore, if someone's really going to look into it, they're going to have to come up with a really good reason why those books are black and those entries are empty.
Yep. And the only thing that's going to result from it is inevitably you cannot, you know, and this could have been predicted back when they set this system up after the war. Inevitably, if you set up a system like that, ultimately it breeds so much corruption, and that corruption in turn breeds mistrust. You can't run a financial system that way.
Right.
You just cannot run it that way. So, you know, we're seeing already the fallout from it. You know, nations trying to negotiate bilateral currency agreements, you know, India and Iran, China and Russia, and so on and so forth. That's only going to increase. As long as this system remains completely opaque, that will only increase until that system just finally collapses.
Right. Well, it's fascinating when you think about it. If we had to look at this period and look at McCarthy and look at Kennedy and look at Cohn, really it's Cohn who comes out of that period in one piece with all the information, knowing about the UFO file, the secret system, and the blackmail and the dirt. And his protege becomes Trump.
And let's look at, you know, let's not forget the other seedy aspect of Roy Cohn, and that is his connections to the Bronfmans.
Right.
That's his connections to other underworld figures. That's his connection through roundabout circuitous interconnections to Epstein. So in other words, Cohn had an immense amount of knowledge of a very detailed nature. And if anyone knew where the bodies were buried, it was him. So, you know, I've been digging into Roy Cohn recently and got a hold of Nicholas von Hoffman's biography, Citizen Cohn.
Oh, yeah.
It's quite an eye-opener. That's all I can say. It's quite an eye-opener because this man it's very clear that he used that knowledge and that experience from his time in D.C. in the Department of Justice and then later with McCarthy. He used that whole body of knowledge plus the experience that he gained in almost every aspect of his dealings with people. And he was able somehow to parlay that into connections that just boggle the mind. Mm. You know, Barbara Walters, just a whole slew of people that you wouldn't imagine would want to be associating not only with Roy Cohn, but for the fact that Roy Cohn is associated with McCarthy. You know, just a whole roster of people that boggle the mind.
Right.
So he clearly was a mover and fixer. Trump wouldn't have built his tower without Roy Cohn having smoothed that out for him. Just no way.
And he must have given him the lay of the land politically in order for president. He knew.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. I think absolutely. You know, Trump began making noises about the presidency long before he came down the elevator. You know, this narrative he's putting out.
Right.
You know, it's exactly that. It's a narrative because he was making those noises for a very long time.
Yeah.
And the other thing, curiously, about Trump is, you know, on 9/11 or other incidents like that, he's always there.
Right.
Gathering information, mm-hmm. you know. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Cohn taught him well.
Right. Exactly. It's amazing. Cohn shows up in the Torbett document.
Yes, he does.
And he shows up as a member of DISC.
Yes, he does.
Defense Industrial Security Command. That's pretty hardcore connection long before Cohn had anything to do on the record with Trump or anything like that. That's the 60s.
Yeah, and if he's in that organization, there's another channel of information.
Right.
For what they're doing in those Monmouth hearings.
Yes.
There's another channel right there. So, you know, he clearly knew more than he was letting on. I mean, you've read those Monmouth transcripts in mm-hmm. the first book, and you can tell when they're asking questions, they're asking, number one, because they know something very specific. Mm-hmm. And number two, they're asking in such a way as to talk about certain subjects without having to talk about them.
Yeah.
So it's very clear that he's, I think, another channel to McCarthy for that type of information. And that, again, would be one of the reasons why they were so intent on shutting McCarthy down by shutting Cohn down.
Right.
Let's remember, the Army-McCarthy hearings were really about trying to get rid of Roy Cohn,
right?
Not Joe McCarthy.
Well, Cohn was probably actually the more dynamic intellect of the two.
Oh, yeah, I think so. McCarthy is... Cohn's intelligence is not just memory, but he's a synthesizer. McCarthy is a judge and a process man, and they complement each other very well when you read how they play off each other in the transcripts, but they are very different types of intellects at work. And Cohn is the synthesizer, and McCarthy is, if you look at McCarthy's questions in those transcripts, very often they're going to process as to why you did it this way and why didn't you do it that way and what's the protocol for handling this type of situation as opposed to that one. Cohn is more about trying to draw the connections between all of these things.
Right.
So it's a very interesting, very complimentary duo when it gets right down to it.
And he does escape intact. So that's mm-hmm. very interesting to me too.
Yeah, yeah.
You put together that thread of assassinations, which was Forrestal, mm-hmm. McCarthy, mm-hmm. JFK, RFK.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very interesting thread.
Yes.
I mean, let somebody out, but it's pretty interesting in that that's how you can get rid of the challenge to the secrecy around the UFO file and the secret yes. system of finance.
Yes. Yeah. It begins with Forrestal, and to me, there's another connection here too that is somehow playing in the background, and I don't know exactly how. But Forrestal is Roman Catholic.
Yes.
The Kennedys are Roman Catholic.
Oh, yes.
McCarthy's Roman Catholic.
Right.
And there's something there, I think. I don't know exactly what. But the fact that all of them die, Forrestal certainly, under extremely suspicious circumstances. Jack Kennedy assassinated, Robert Kennedy assassinated, and Senator McCarthy dying under extremely suspicious circumstances.
Yeah.
I personally, I think probably Forrestal and McCarthy were both murdered.
Yeah.
You know, the funeral that they gave for McCarthy in the Senate was just over the top. It was almost like a mea culpa, you know, please forgive us. You know, we're glad to be rid of you, but at least we're sending you off in style. But,
thanks for the memories.
Yeah, thanks for the memories. But, you know, he died just a few months before I was born. So, you know, it was May of 1957. But they all die in either very suspicious circumstances or clearly were just taken out. And I'm wondering all the time what this was about. And there's that very peculiar reference that Senator McCarthy makes in that speech on Marshall that he gives on the floor of the Senate to the Merovingian in the White House.
Oh, right.
Now, you know, I don't even think John Calhoun, who was a very educated man, ever gave any reference that obscure and wow, that obtuse on the floor of the United States Senate. And here McCarthy comes along and is talking about Merovingians. And, you know, if there, think Dan Brown. Yeah, think Dan Brown here, folks. Think Holy Blood, Holy Grail. I mean, that has such resonances to it that, again, I can't see McCarthy dropping that into a speech without trying to send a message. The question is, what's the message he's sending, you know, and to whom?
Well, also that he, I'm trying to think of the details here, but he went after Marshall about the long dock.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. One of the major decisions that McCarthy challenged Marshall for having made was this Operation Anvil invasion, amphibious invasion of southern France, you know, landings from Marseille to Toulon and so on, and then this drive up the Rhone Valley and into the Languedoc and Aquitaine. And it was totally, wow, from a military point of view, it was totally, completely unnecessary. Because by that time, the Nazis were in full retreat out of France.
Right.
And, you know, General Clark and Winston Churchill were saying, well, we could have used those military resources to push from northern Italy into Yugoslavia and completely unhinge the Nazis in Eastern Europe, keep the Russians out of the Balkans, and voila, happy ending.
Right.
And no, we've got to invade southern France. And I suspect that the reason really lies in the fact that the SS at that time, as the Germans are retreating, is on a mad dash in southern France under Otto Skorzeny, Hitler's favorite commando, no less, going around, digging up the Languedoc and Aquitaine, looking for something. And, you know, and they're doing it with the SS von Salza regiment, which I think is very interesting because Konrad von Salza was who? He was the first Grand Master of the Teutonic Order.
Oh, right.
So, you know, something's going on with the SS in southern France. And I think really there was an intelligence agenda behind that invasion, not a military one.
Right.
And that Marshall, nothing I've read about General Marshall, Daniel, indicates to me that he had any sort of esoteric or occult fascination, but Franklin Roosevelt did.
Yes.
And if Roosevelt had found out or heard about intelligence, well, we'd better go in there and find out what those Nazis are, you know, digging around for and see if we can find it. I think there was an intelligence agenda to it.
Fascinating. Roosevelt had very deep esoteric knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The Long Dock in that area, it's obviously what they were looking for could have been associated with a subject you know very well, which is the Knights Templar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems like that's what was going on there.
Well, before the war in the 1930s, Himmler had sent Otto Rahn. I don't know if you know that name. He had sent Otto Rahn to Aquitaine and the Long Dock. And Rahn wrote a couple of very weird, I mean weird, books about his experience in that region of southern France. And basically, Rahn argued that the Parsifal romance was all about the Templar activity in that region of France, about the Holy Grail, and so on and so forth. And as he was in southern France, he ran into a shepherd who told him part of their local lore was that Pope Not So Innocent III had well, Lotario Cardinal de Conti, let's call him by his real name, had ordered the Albigensian Crusade in southern France because he was really looking for one of the stones from Lucifer's crown so that he could put it on the papal tiara. And that was the local lore that this shepherd told Otto Rahn. And Otto Rahn publishes books, and of course Heinrich Himmler reads them. So there was SS interest in southern France before the outbreak of the Second World War. And I suspect that those stories about Otto Skorzeny, the von Salza regiment going around and scooping something up in southern France, have a kernel of truth to them. And therefore that, you know, we've got to invade southern France when militarily we don't need to. I suspect they were trying to find out what the SS was looking for, or to recover it if the SS had not.
Is there any evidence that the SS did recover it?
Yes. There are stories. The person that reports about this SS expedition in August of 1944 is a fellow by the name of William Buchner. And they're in two little self-published books that he records this incident as it was told to him by a German POW. Mm-hmm. And there is a strange thing that when Frau Bormann, Bormann's wife, was apprehended by the Allies in, I think it was some pass in Italy, coming over the pass from Austria, that she was apprehended with about 2,000 gold coins. I don't know if you've ever heard this story. And the coins were of, they were old and they were of unknown provenance.
Ah.
No one knew, you know, who made these dang things. But she apparently had been carrying these gold coins with her. And my suspicion is, given the strange activity that I reported on in Thrice Great Hermetica in the Janus Age and Financial Vipers of Venice, there was counterfeiting activity that was going on in the Languedoc and in Aquitaine in France, where they were actually counterfeiting gold French coins that were of better quality than the actual official French coins. And I'm thinking, okay, what's that mean? Well, it means a source of bullion,
yeah,
which the region's not known for. And it means a smelting and coining technology that's better than, so I'm thinking Templars.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking New World bullion sources,
right,
and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's all sorts of strange stuff going on there.
Fascinating. Does that story involve skywriting?
Yes.
That's the one.
Yeah, that's the one. Because
that's incredible.
Because according to the story, Skorzeny apparently found whatever it was they were looking for. He telegraphs Himmler and said, "We found it." And then Himmler apparently commissioned a a Fiesler Stork, which is one of these little single engine planes, to skywrite at noon on a certain day something, and I forget what it was that they wrote in the sky to commemorate the event. You know, Himmler being Himmler.
Wow.
That's the story.
So yeah. That really brings us around, because if Marshall got into trouble over that, that looks like what Roosevelt sent him in there to follow up on.
Yeah, I think there's an intelligence agenda. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. That invasion was as large as the D-Day landings. It was about a quarter of a million men, 10 crack free French divisions on top of it. So in other words, the French are invading France for the United States, you know. But you know, the presence of the French divisions makes sense because they know the region.
Okay.
And particularly if anybody, you know, the Languedoc has the spoken French in the Languedoc is very different than the French that you and I are accustomed to. Most Frenchmen will say "we," and in the Languedoc it's "oi." So in other words, it's a very different pronunciation of the language. So you have to know the dialect. And I suspect that's another little indicator here that there was intelligence going on behind the scenes. I doubt very much that Marshall, incompetent as a military commander he was, according to MacArthur and Pershing, that Marshall was that incompetent to recognize we don't need to invade southern France. They're already retreating. I think this has to come from much higher than Marshall, and the only person that it comes from is Roosevelt. Roosevelt's got this intelligence, and oh yeah, we better make sure that those Nazis don't escape to nationalist Spain or something, you know.
Right.
To cover up what he's really after, whatever that may be.
Search and retrieval.
Yeah, search and retrieval.
Yeah. And that's another secret that McCarthy blows out of the water.
By referencing Merovingians?
Wow.
Yeah. Where are the Merovingians from? They're from southern France.
Right.
So, we have a Roman Catholic senator talking about Merovingians in a speech about Marshall sending messages to the Merovingian in the White House, Harry Truman, who happens to be a Freemason. So, make of it what you will, folks. But, you know, there's no way that was not a carefully chosen reference. I mean, what U.S. senator at that time can you think of that would drop a reference like that into the middle of a speech on General Marshall on the floor of the Senate?
Amazing. It just hangs there.
Saying, look at me, probe further.
Absolutely. Joseph, the quote you have on the back from McCarthy is from June of 1951. It says, "This must be the product of a great conspiracy, a conspiracy of infamy so black, mm-hmm. that when it is finally exposed, its principles shall be forever deserving of the maledictions of all honest men."
That's from that speech on the floor of the Senate.
Wow. That's putting it where it is.
Incredible. Now, with that Merovingian reference blinking on and off in that speech, what's he really talking about?
Yeah.
What really is he talking about? Merovingians don't really go in most people's minds with an association to communist infiltration of subversion.
Right.
Just a thought.
Wow. Incredible. Yeah. McCarthy, Marshall, and the other international. Roosevelt, Trotsky, Stalin, in America's Progressivist Deep State. This is an incredible book, and it's the follow-up to the McCarthy book, but it goes deeper into this side, which is never covered.
Never.
It really is just not.
That was the most astonishing thing about all of this, Daniel, is, you know, I've read the old line McCarthy scholarship, if you want to call it that. I've read Oshinsky's book. I've read Arthur Herman's book. I've read Stanton Evans' book. I've read William F. Buckley's book. None of them, not one of them, ever talk about Suzanne La Follette, the Dewey Commission, the little Marshall Litvinoff connection that he drops into his book. None of them talk about this. And to me, that's significant because that means to a certain extent, they're still trying to perpetuate a narrative by omission. Right. And these are big omissions. These are not little omissions. These are big. And for someone of his political stature at the time, to be mentioning these things openly.
Yeah.
That's huge.
And what's amazing too is that's in terms of traditional history. Mm-hmm. And those would be the biographers, the historians that would go after it. They've left it on the cutting room floor.
Yep.
And but then you brought out McCarthy and the UFO file, which the ufology end of the spectrum has never had any inkling of.
Well, can you blame them? Would you associate Joseph McCarthy with UFOs? No. That's, you know, I was as flabbergasted as anybody else was. It's so totally weird that all of these things, all of these weird connections coalesce in that man.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not accidental. That's not accidental. Just the fact, I mean, no one that I know has ever mentioned this, the, or drawn attention to the potential significance of Harry Dexter White having taught at a college in McCarthy's hometown.
Right.
Or Suzanne La Follette being one of the commissioners on the Dewey Commission. No one has ever pointed any of this out. And to me, that screams that this guy didn't just get picked by accident by a group of three people from the Pentagon. They researched him and vetted him very carefully. I'd like to know who the other three were.
Right. Yeah. Wow. That is the key point on that list.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Mm-hmm. And interesting to know that McCarthy was at the bottom.
At the bottom. Right. Yeah. Right. But those facts give you a little potential template by which to construct a profile of what they might have been looking for.
Right.
And that narrows things down considerably.
Wow. Amazing.
I've got my suspicions, but I won't share them now.
Well, it's funny because I was just going to ask you, and you know, this is an incredible book. You just brought it out, and it's available at GizaDustStar.com. Mm-hmm.
It's actually a Lulu self-published book, so they can go directly to Lulu and look my name up, and they can find it. But there, it is on the website on the front page. They can just click it, and it should take them to the
fantastic
Lulu area.
But I know you and how you work in advance. Are you already into something else?
Well, listen.
I have a sense.
Don't make me laugh. Look, I started out last year doing two books.
Yes.
And I told people that one book is very difficult for me to write because it is about such very dark things. So I'm researching this book, and at the same time, I'm doing other stuff, and I ran across a reference in the research for the dark book. And I went, oh, you know what? A four-letter word meaning defecation. And I thought, oh, boy, I've got to change the order yet again. I've got to do another McCarthy book. So, yeah, there's a little thing that hasn't been tied into this yet. And it's a fleeting thing. It's a very fleeting thing.
Wow.
But it does strongly suggest that there was an aspect of sexual politics and blackmail going on behind the scenes during this whole committee era that, again, has not ever been brought to light and looked at from the standpoint of all of the political machinations that are occurring at the time. So I thought, okay, I've got to put that book aside and go do this book. And so I started this second McCarthy book, and that's when I had that hand slap, face palm to the head moment, and realized that no one is looking at McCarthy's book coming out in 1954 in the political context of what was going on and in the context of what he's actually saying by way of new material that he puts into the book.
Wow.
You know, all that stuff about Marshall and Pearl Harbor and Thomas Dewey and all of that stuff. What he was doing was, you know, typical Joe McCarthy. He was saying, okay, boys, if you want to take this all the way, I'm prepared to do so. And I'm the one with subpoena power. So, yeah, it's caused me to look at this whole McCarthy thing, and particularly the Army McCarthy hearing, with entirely new glasses on.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's quite a cast of characters in itself. You know, Stuart Symington, Carl Munt, Henry Jackson, Everett Dirksen. All of these people. Secretary Stevens, Dwight Eisenhower, Roy Cohn, you know, all that's a who's who of that era.
Yeah.
And they're all drawn into this maelstrom. It's caused me to look at it in a very different way. You know, I'm not saying that McCarthy's coming out of this as some big hero, but by the same token, he's coming out of it with his patriotism intact. And that, I think, is the key to the man. You know, whatever his personal faults were, and there were zillions of them, but whatever his personal faults were, he was genuinely, I think, patriotic. And ultimately, that was his motivation. But it's all this other stuff that...
Incredible. You know, yeah.
It's to my mind, Daniel, there's no way to understand the man without doing a massive amount of revisionist history.
Yeah.
There's just no way. There's just no way. The Monmouth transcripts make that very clear. And again, why has not even Stanton Evans and his massive study on McCarthy, even he does not look at these transcripts. And I suspect a certain amount of it is you're not looking for UFOs.
Right.
You're not looking for occupation money plates and missing money.
Right.
You know, you're looking for McCarthy and communists. You know, and he either was a bad guy or he was a good guy solely on that score. All this other stuff isn't even on their radar.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is kind of an indictment of modern mainline scholarship, is they can't see what's there because they're only looking for the obvious stuff.
It reminds me of when they roll out these kind of, you know, biographers to do histories of LBJ or something, and they were like, well, he was a tough man, but you know, he wanted to get things done.
Yeah.
The complex figure of LBJ, you know.
The complex figure, and the few people died along the way, but that was necessary in order to pursue his vision. And yeah, it's quackademia at its best. I mean, what are you saying?
Yeah. Well, what you did with McCarthy is you brought him out so people can see what's going on here. And there's no doubt the transcripts help dramatically.
Oh, my.
Because they're indisputable.
Yeah, you know, just on the communist issue alone, reading the transcripts is an eye-opener. Because over, you know, and you expect this to happen, especially with him. But over and over again, he's got somebody on the stand, and Cohn or McCarthy or somebody starts questioning. And the questions are always very detailed. You know, they're very specific, very detailed. Again, I claim the constitutional privilege. And this is not just one time. not 10 times, not 20 times. It's hundreds of times. So that should tell people something. This was not about someone from Wisconsin making stuff up out of his head. This was a real thing, and it was a real threat. And he wasn't making it up. That's just at the level that we're used to. But Roswell, UFOs, atomic cannons, radar spies, occupation money, missing money. Well, yeah. That you don't expect. Not to mention Merovingians.
Well, we just have to find out what conspiracy he was talking about.
Well, that's my question.
Yeah.
You know, to drop that reference in, and then in a speech talking about a massive conspiracy. And incidentally, the quotation on the back of the cover is from the context in which that Merovingian comment occurs. So, you know, what is he really talking about? And he was Byzantine and sneaky and cunning. Mm-hmm. And references like that are not happenstance. He was too smart of a man and too well educated for that to be happenstance. So, you know, make of it what you will, folks.
Incredible. Wow, the book, McCarthy, Marshall, and the Other International. Just fascinating reading. Joseph, it's great to see you.
Thanks for having me back, Daniel.
Incredible work. And everyone can go to Giza Death Star to find it. It is the follow-up to the McCarthy Monmouth book, which is explosive in terms of its implications.
Yeah, it was. I wrote this one in the same fit of fury as I did the Monmouth book. I just thought this stuff is too out there. I've got to put it out there before someone scoops me.
Right. You made it.
I made it. Yes. Barely. I did.
Thank you for joining us for this fascinating episode with Dr. Joseph Farrell. You can find more deep interviews by subscribing at darkjournalist.com. Join us on Friday nights at 8 p.m. for the X Steganography series. See you soon. Oh,